is Monday Night History. When the British naturalist Charles Darwin had his book On the Origin of Species published in 1859, it was a scientific sensation. Surely one of the most important and influential books ever published. The book, which outlined Darwin's theory of evolution and how it was driven by a process called natural selection, became one of the most important scientific texts ever produced, even to this day. But did you know that the seeds for his theory were partially sown during a brief trip to Australia about 20 years earlier? Associate Professor John Haymans, a medical historian at the University of Melbourne and a very keen observer of Charles Darwin and his work, he joins us to explain what made the biggest impressions on Darwin while he was here in Australia and shed some light on why he was plagued by illness so often as well. John Haymans, good evening and welcome to Nightlife.
Thank you.
How did Darwin end up visiting Australia? He was on this seemingly endless long voyage at the time, wasn't he?
Yes, I agree. I think it was seeming endless to him too. It was meant to be a three-year voyage, but in fact it went on for 5 years, and when he got to Australia he was in the fifth year, and he was already quite jet-lagged, I suppose we can use that term.
Yeah, exactly. But what an adventure. It was in 1831, he'd been recommended to accompany a Captain Robert Fitzroy on what was to be a two-year surveying expedition to South America. What was that voyage all about?
Well, it was the coast of South America wasn't known accurately, and they wanted to survey it and improve the maps of that area. But also they wanted to check on the longitude of several ports. And Fitzroy had, I think, 16 or something like that chronometers on board. And it was those chronometers which were the key to forming the accurate longitudes of all these various ports. And that was one reason, at least, why they called it the three points in Australia, in Sydney, in Hobart, and in King George's Sound in Western Australia. So, yes, but it was a long trip, and Fitzroy was very particular. He would go back over just to check that he was right the first time. Mm. They travelled backwards and forwards on several occasions.
Yes, well, if you look at that massive, broken, serrated coastline on the Pacific coast of South America down at the bottom of Chile and Argentina, you can see the complexity of that coast. Fitzroy sailed in there. I mean, there's a Mount Fitzroy in Chile named after Robert Fitzroy after he'd sailed up one of these in seemingly endless sounds to view the area. Why was Darwin on board?
Well, the previous captain of the Beagle had committed suicide, and it was quite an ordeal to be a captain on one board of these ships, because you weren't allowed to socialise with other officers. You had to keep yourself to yourself. And they thought that having a gentleman companion on board would help Fitzroy and prevent him from becoming too depressed or too anxious or doing the same thing as the previous captain of the Beagle. So he was there as a gentleman companion for Fitzroy, but he was also there because of his scientific and his geology knowledge, and that was one reason. Apart from the fact that he was a gentleman, that was one reason why he was nominated for the voyage.
Mm. So the voyage gets underway in December 1831 from Plymouth in England, and they survey the coast of South America, then this extraordinary voyage. They sail then west to the Galapagos Islands, where Darwin, of course, is mesmerised by what he sees. They then move on. Just think about these distances. They then move on to Tahiti and New Zealand. They've sailed right across the Pacific. And then they arrive in Australia, and they sail into Sydney Harbour in January 1836. So as you say, they're in their fifth year by now. Darwin, well, the colony is only relatively new, isn't it? What does Darwin do when he gets here? He sets off on a trek through the Blue Mountains towards Bathurst, doesn't he?
Yeah, so there's no stopping him. I mean, the day after he arrives, he engages a man and hires him with two horses, and off they go. And the first night he gets to a little town just out of Sydney along a very well-made road and quite busy. They pass two stagecoaches, and he spends the first night at Emu Crossing just out of Sydney. And then the next day he's up into the Blue Mountains and Blackheath, and then he's on his way to Bathurst. There was no stopping him, that's for sure.
Mm. Yes, he must have heard about the animals, of course, the unique and distinctive animals of Australia, I imagine, from earlier writings. I mean, as I say, the colony had been settled since 1788. Yes. But he sees plenty of wildlife, including the mythical platypus, of course, and kangaroo rats. He notices that animals in the Southern Hemisphere were adaptively similar to animals of different species in the Northern Hemisphere, doesn't he?
Yes. Yes. He sort of queries as why this should be so, and he even questions whether there might have been two separate origins for these animals.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Excuse me.
That's right. This observation, of course, later supports his theory of natural selection, which he's developing. He develops this many years later when he publishes On the Origin of Species in 1859. Darwin wasn't the first person to think of this or to toy with these ideas, was he? Although at this point in time, the dominant belief, religious and cultural, an establishment was creationism, the idea that the Bible had the lowdown on what happened, and
yes.
That's how the world began. That's how people thought about the world. These ideas were so completely contrary to the way that people conceived of the world. You can imagine the shock of when they were floated. When did Darwin come to the view that the world may have evolved and not created?
I think towards the end of the 1830s, he obviously thought about it a lot, and it was not until he read about the overcrowding and how it was that, I think, that triggered him. And once he got onto the idea of natural selection as a mechanism, then he was away. And it was that idea that I think really... I think he thought about evolution, but he hadn't worked out how it happened. It was only when he came upon natural selection that he could really sort of put it all together and make a striking case for it.
Mm. Yeah, it's astonishing the journeys he made, the places he'd been. He makes some observations about the geology of the Blue Mountains' spectacular Jameson Valley. What were they?
Oh, he was most impressed with this. And I've seen it too, and you probably have. It certainly is a very impressive. And he couldn't believe that such a huge valley had been formed by alluvial action with just one or two small streams flowing into it. And, I think later on he realised that he was wrong and that it was all due to alluvial action and that the sandstone was very soft and easily eroded. But it's certainly a spectacular valley. And he was quite impressed with all of this sort of thing.
Mm. He certainly gets about, doesn't he? He also goes to Hobart in Tasmania before going to Albany in Western Australia. What does he think about the Aboriginal population, by the way? Does he encounter them in any great degree?
Yes, he met with a group. He met them on several occasions. He met them at Bathurst. And he met them in Western Australia where he witnessed a corroboree. But in Sydney, he met a group of about 20, and they impressed him with their ability to throw a spear. And they could throw a spear through a hat at 20 paces. And they were as good as any archer with their ability to throw spears. But he still thought that they were a doomed race. just as he thought that the kangaroo was doomed to extinction. So he wasn't always right in his predictions.
Mm. Why did he think the kangaroo was doomed to extinction?
Well, he thought they were being eliminated by the white settler. And he never saw a kangaroo. He saw a kangaroo rat, which, of course, is a miniature form of kangaroo.
Oh, he never actually saw a kangaroo.
He never saw a kangaroo. He was lucky to see platypus. It's a bit sad that his companion shot one for him. But, yes. But, he never saw a kangaroo.
It's astonishing that he never came across an eastern grey kangaroo in all of those travels. During this entire time, though, that he was here, he was often sick, wasn't he? I mean, this is not something that people often know about Darwin. During the whole of the voyage, including in South America, he had headaches and episodes of weakness and faintness. It wasn't normal seasickness, was it?
No, it certainly wasn't normal seasickness. It was very abnormal. And it was seasickness that actually got worse as the voyage progressed. And when he was travelling between New Zealand and Australia, he commented on how bad his sickness was during that time. And again, of course, going from Melbourne to Western Australia, going from Hobart to Western Australia, he experienced seasickness again. And I think this was part of his illness. His illness had many of the characteristics of the cyclic vomiting, and patients who have cyclic vomiting today often experience motion sickness. And some of it can be very bad. I mean, they have one patient relates how she can't see children on a swing in the playground without getting sick. Mm. So it can be quite severe, and it's due to I think vestibular problems.
Professor John Hayman's my guest, a medical historian at the University of Melbourne. We're talking about the life and times of Charles Darwin, particularly his Charles Darwin in Australia, where he was for some time. Did he ever return to Australia after that voyage?
No, he never. He actually never left Britain after that. He did make a trip up to Scotland, but no, he never went overseas again. And he never wanted to either. I think he was very happy to settle it down where he stayed. And people came to see him, but he'd go away to different counties, and of course he went away for all his treatment at different resorts. But basically, he stayed at home from there on.
Mm. Yeah, he did correspond, of course, didn't he? With he had an assistant on board the ship, Sims Covington, who himself migrated to New South Wales, and the midshipman Philip King joined his father. Captain Philip Parker King, who was the son of the governor, Philip Gidley King, and he also sent Darwin back information. So he did keep in touch. The Beagle itself, though, did return to Australia, didn't it?
Yes, it was the third voyage of the Beagle, and it was under Captain Wickham, who was on the same ship, same voyage as Darwin was. And it was on that voyage that they discovered what they call Port Darwin. And they named it after their shipboard companion. And, of course, later on, Port Darwin became the home for Darwin when the settlement was shifted in the Northern Territory. So Darwin's name is commemorated, that's for sure.
Oh, okay. So that area around the northern, because after all, the Gulf of Carpentaria had been known about, hadn't it?
Yes, but not mapped accurately, and certainly Port Darwin hadn't been discovered until the third voyage. Of course, it's only got a small entry, and it's an ideal harbour in many ways.
Yes, yes, and of course it now bears his name. Yes, it's hard to encompass the breadth of his achievement, of course, and also the extent of that voyage of Darwin's and the Beagle, which traversed, in the southern hemisphere at least, much of the known world. And the unknown too. It's been a pleasure talking to you, John. Thank you,
Phil.
John Heyman, who is a medical historian at the University of Melbourne, Professor John Heyman, talking about the life and times of Charles Darwin in Australia. As I say, he was just such an extraordinary voyage, and the effect, of course, it had on the world can hardly be measured.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.